Blind Cool Tech listeners, and welcome to yet another podcast. Sam Britton here with you, and this is being recorded on a Wednesday afternoon, and it is hot around here. I don't know about where some of you are this week, as we're experiencing summer in a large way, but it is over 90 degrees here, and summer is definitely here and in full swing, and we're just hanging in here doing this kind of stuff. You know, hey, this is one thing you can do when it's too hot to do anything else. You got to do something when you're in this air conditioning. So, you know, what can you say? Anyway, welcome to another edition of our podcast here for Blind Cool Tech. I almost want to say the name of my radio show, but I have to reprogram my brain. This is not your radio show. This is a podcast. So anyway, I do have to remember that. So if you hear me accidentally slip and say the information corner, that's because sometimes we have a tendency to get in robot mode when you do that all the time, and you forget sometimes what you're doing. So anyway, that's the deal there. Okay, one of the things that I know a lot of you have done, and we do it here, and we're always wanting to know, is things that are accessible for blind people. And there's all kinds of things that we like to do with our computers that we want to be accessible, particularly those of us with a Macintosh, because we're dealing with new screen reading software. While it's a great thing right out of the box, it's also problematic sometimes in that its limitations get in the way. And that is the fact of applications having to be written just a certain way in order to work with VoiceOver. Now, this program that we're going to do today is for those of you that are running System 10. VoiceOver works on Cocoa applications only, at least to the best of my knowledge. I have got some other things that I am running around here on System 10. I am currently evaluating Eudora's email program, their email server program. And to date, I can only administrate it from OS 9. However, we have been proud users of the program Rumpus, which is an FTP program now for, this is June, and we made our purchase of Rumpus back in December. And I don't know about you, but if you're like me, it's nice to have control over your own server sometimes. This program may not be for everybody. Some of you may just be perfectly content with storing your files on a remote server, and you're perfectly comfortable with that. For me, I got tired of always worrying about bandwidth, how much bandwidth I was using, and that, you know, and I'm not faulting the person who had that server. That was their deal, and they paid for that bandwidth, and it could get pretty astronomical if all of a sudden a bunch of big files were uploaded and downloaded. Now, most of you may never have a need for this, but if you're a broadcaster and you're heavily relying on the internet, you need disk space. You need the capabilities of uploading and downloading big files. And in my case, I need to be able to upload our MP3s of the broadcast and share them with the gentleman who runs Dixie Broadcasting so he can put them on the air on the weekends and run the pre-recorded edition. We'll enter Rumpus FTP server into the mix. And we have the author of that program from Maxim Development. John, first of all, I want to welcome you to this podcast here. Welcome, and thanks for all that you're doing there.
Hi, Sam. Excuse me. Hi, Sam. Thank you.
It's glad to... I'm glad, if I can talk straight here, I'm glad to have you here. And one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on is because out of all the programs I've messed with on the Macintosh, Rumpus is probably one of the easiest programs to work. It takes all the pain out of setting up an FTP server. And I don't know about the rest of the people listening to this podcast, but if you're like me, time is valuable. You don't have time to sit there and constantly mess with command line and terminal code and stuff like that. Although, you know, now and then, you know, we all have to do that. But the cool thing about Rumpus is that if you're looking for something that will help ease that problem and give you plenty of access to server space right on one of your own computers, then it's a program that is worth taking a look at. And the good thing about it is that they can download it certainly for free and try it for 30 days. But let's go back, John. How did Rumpus come into existence? What was the thing that actually got Rumpus taking off? Or maybe for that matter, Maxim Development, because essentially you and your wife are Maxim Development.
Yeah, that's true. Maxim started back in about 1994 when the web was really just in its infancy. Netscape Navigator had just come out, version 0.9. And there was this little web server for Mac OS, it was probably 7 at the time, called Mac HTTP.
Yeah.
And I developed a little add-on for that called NetCloak, mm-hmm. and put it out there, and it just sort of took off. It was actually the first commercially available internet server software for the Macintosh, and as far as I know, any platform. So NetCloak sort of took off, and the company started growing. We got up to, you know, 10 employees or so, and had a really good relationship with Apple. And Apple, NetCloak was included there, and we actually developed the personal web server in Mac OS 8 and 9 mm-hmm. is actually a Maxim software.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, so we did a lot of projects with Apple, and they came to us and said, you know, there's no FTP server for the platform. At the time, they had a product called the Apple Internet Server Solution, AISS.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a hole. I mean, they didn't have an FTP server. So they said, why don't you write one? And we did.
Wow. And FTP is just, oh, ever since the first time I ever messed with FTP was when a friend of mine who educated me on the Macintosh works up in Kansas City at the community colleges up there. He introduced me to file transfer protocol, and I went in there, and at the time, my experience was the InfoMac and the and various archives of software, and I thought, you know, this is so cool. This is so blind-friendly, you know, for blind people, because I could skip a lot of these graphical web interfaces, and I could just go in and, you know, just pull it right on down, and I had, you know, I had a good workaround, and of course, back then, it was Anarchy, which was put out by Peter Lewis at the time, and so I was thrilled with it, and that's why I say when this came along, I couldn't pass it up. And I, again, like I say, we're dealing with software that is probably marketed for a special niche. Not everybody's going to want a server, but if you want one, I've never found anything that's more easily set up. And how did the name Rumpus come around for the server? You told that to me in an email, but I want you to share that with the listeners of the podcast here.
Well, you know, when you're developing software and before it's released, you have, you know, like a project code name. You know, you look at the versions of the OS and you have Tiger and Panther. And so we needed a project code name for our new FTP server. And we batted them around for a week or two. And one night I was reading to my kids in bed, and we were reading Where the Wild Things Are, which is a classic book by Maurice Sendak.
Yeah.
And in the book, the little boy goes by boat to this island with these monsters, and they have this big party, and he shouts, let the wild rumpus start. And I read the sentence, and I thought, rumpus is a cool word. Let's use that. So we used the name rumpus. The word rumpus is our project code name. And when it came time to release the software, it had just kind of became synonymous with the product. So we left it.
Wow. I know that a lot of people, when they would see that, you know, at first, when I first started the server, a lot of people didn't realize what that was all about. And, of course, I hadn't customized the thing. You can customize the thing with your own logo and your own, you know, whatever you want. When people log in, you can customize it to your company or to whatever it is you're working with. And I hadn't customized it. And I had some people, what is Rumpus? And I said, oh, yeah, that's the server software. I'm sorry. You know, that kind of thing. So it was kind of fun.
Well, to this day, I'm still trying to think of a tagline for the product that makes the name seem like it makes sense. You know, I thought about make some noise on the web, because rumpus is associated with loud noises, you know, or
yeah,
make some noise on the net or something along those lines. So if anyone ever thinks of a tagline that makes the word rumpus make sense for an FTP server, send me an email.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can find John's email link right on the website. In fact, one of the things I want to mention, and this is why I'm interviewing John today, is because there are a lot of people I deal with and, you know, in Macintosh software, a lot of shareware vendors, and Rumpus is really, would you call it shareware or more commercialware? It's shareware in the sense that you get to try it for 30 days and see if you like it. But what would you label it, John?
Well, I consider it commercial software, if for no other reason than it is a little bit expensive. A lot of times shareware people expect it to be, you know, $8 or $20 or something in that neighborhood. But because we provide we really focus on providing technical support, solid documentation, and a fully tested application, I consider it commercial software. We also do have packaging available. Not too many people choose to have us send them that. We usually just send an email with a serial number.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, for people who want to have a box on a shelf, we still have that available. So I consider it commercial shareware with a commercial software with a trial version available.
Yeah, so you got kind of the best of both worlds, which is
right.
Which is nice. And right out of the gate, I mean, when I talked to you, I knew that was going to be some software that we could use, because I'll tell you, I've run into some people in this business. It's a wonder they have any customers at all by their attitude. And the way you operate over there is probably the best I've seen out of vendors that I've dealt with. I mean, and one of the things we've lost in this country is that people, when a person does a good job, they ought to be compensated for the work that they do. And the thing that goes into software, writing the software, is probably what, half the battle. But then you got the tech support end of it, and if you don't give real good tech support, then what good is the software, right?
Yeah, I think that when you use a piece of software, you know, it's not just about the function that you're trying to get done. It's about the interface and having it be easy to use, and also having the support and the resources you need to get your job done. Because if the software works, but you can't figure out how to make it do what you want, then, you know, it may as well not be there. So Rumpus is definitely a package, and I actually probably spend maybe a quarter of my time actually writing software. The other three quarters is documentation, creating example files, maintaining the FAQs on the website, and doing technical support.
Absolutely. And you do this all out of your home. It's just you and your wife out of your home. It's a home business, which is great, I think, because you don't have to worry about all the stress that everybody else puts up with commuting into work. It may have its other problems, but that is one good thing about it. But the thing that is neat is it's a family business. You're doing it as a way to bring income in for the family, and you're able to do it without ever having to leave. So the kids have you there, and it's just it looks like a win-win to me.
Yeah, it's worked out really well. Like I said, a few years ago, the company had grown to, I don't know, 10 or 12 people. And when Steve Jobs came back to Apple, it really shook things up. The Apple Internet Server Solution, which was our bread and butter at the time, essentially disappeared overnight. And so when that happened, we sort of reorganized the business a little bit, and just to wait and see what happened. And it turns out, I mean, at the time we had five or six products, and you know, Rumpus is pretty much the only one left. It's done really well, and so we've kind of just hitched our pony to that. So
yeah, I don't blame you. I mean, Apple is really, unfortunately, there's been a lot of curves thrown our way too in this, because about the time you get satisfied that you worked a lot of stuff out of a program, then all of a sudden here comes System 10, which is a totally different. Of course, you probably had some idea, didn't you, when by the time System 9 came around, weren't they gradually adding more and more Unix code into the operating system? Is that the way they did that, John?
No, it was pretty much an overnight shift. I mean, if you remember back in the OS 8 and 9 days, you know, Apple was in trouble under, you know, Gil Amelio, and things weren't looking very good. Their Copeland project was really not going anywhere, and Apple looked to when they were thinking about where they were headed, they actually looked at two different companies. One was B and the other was Next. And, you know, Next won out. And as far as I'm concerned, Apple didn't buy Next. Next took over Apple.
Yeah.
And that was a huge, huge shift. I mean, it was actually, today, you would have been better off being a Next developer coming into OS X than a Mac developer by far.
Yeah.
So it really was a pretty big curveball for us. And it wasn't only that, but in the restructuring that happened after that happened, or after Next took over Apple, you know, a lot of our contacts and a lot of our the people that we had been working with at Apple sort of disappeared. The corporate structure within Apple really changed. And in the end, it was for the better. I mean, I think it was a great thing for the Mac community. I think Mac OS X is an extremely solid product. I'm happy to be a part of the community.
Yeah.
But as a software developer, it was a tough transition.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the thing that's so challenging is sometimes you don't know what's coming your way until all of a sudden it hits, I would imagine. Or do you have any, do you sometimes as a developer get some contact information to give you some indication that something heavy is coming down the pike and somehow you're going to have to absorb it?
Well, the transition to OS X was announced, you know, to everybody, to the world, pretty early on, quite a while before they actually did the final transition.
Right.
So we definitely had some notice, although at the time, what Apple did when OS X, I mean, the OS 9 was, it's hard. Those of us in the community really felt like it was a great internet server platform. Those of us in the internet server community,
mm-hmm.
But Steve Jobs and the people at Apple, I don't think really believed in the OS, in the Mac OS, the classic Mac OS as a server platform at all.
Yeah.
And so the very first thing, I mean, before you could buy OS X for your desktop machine, Apple came out with OS X Server.
I remember
and
that.
In fact,
yeah.
That came out, I think, a year before OS X Client.
Yeah.
So the transition, you know, was probably difficult for a lot of Mac developers. It was even more difficult for the server developers because that was kind of thrust on us pretty early. And that original OS X Server product from Apple was not terribly robust. If you remember OS X, the original OS X and 10.1, it really took Apple a while to get their feet under them. And OS X Server was really pre-release software.
One interesting bug that was cleared up by the changeover to 10 for those of us with screen readers is back in the days of 8 and 9, I was running Outspoken, and I remember before I contacted you the first time, I had downloaded Rumpus 3.5.6, which is for OS 9, because I wanted some sort of server software running around here in the worst way, so I downloaded it. Fortunate enough, was able to get it to work with Outspoken, but the one problem that we had was, if I did large transfers, it would all of a sudden I'd get a message on the screen saying Rumpus has unexpectedly quit because an error of type 1 occurred. And apparently what we've got is it's a problem with the screen reader is what it was, which is, of course, irrelevant now. We're past that. But the interesting thing about it, the reason I bring this up is because under System 10, that all cleared up because for the first time, the way Rumpus is constructed, the actual application is a controller, and the actual FTP serving runs as what's called a background daemon process. And so there's no application to force quit if things get goofy or whatever. And it's just been stable as a rock compared to how you had to run it under a 9. And I would imagine that under 9, everything was pretty much restricted to either being a control panel or an application, wasn't it?
Yeah. The OS 9 definitely presented some challenges for applications like Rumpus. It was not, the multitasking was what's called cooperative multitasking.
Yeah.
So, in other words, every application was responsible for doing a little piece of work and then saying, okay, I'm done, someone else can go. And then each application would take turns in that way. The problem is if you get one bad program in the mix that decides not to let go of the CPU, nothing works. So, for example, some of the FTP clients on Mac OS 9, when they were reading a file, they wouldn't release the CPU. So if you used an FTP client and Rumpus on the same machine, Rumpus would start serving the file, and the client would start accepting it, and then it would just sit there waiting for more data, of course never releasing the CPU so that Rumpus could serve some more. So we had problems like that. And the other big thing probably for people trying to use the screen reading software was that the interface, how you developed an interface for an application, was less robust. And Rumpus, in fact, pretty much ignored all of the operating system utilities for doing interface. And I had written all of the interface utilities myself because I wasn't happy with the stuff that was in the system.
Yeah.
So since every application did its interface differently, the screen reading software doesn't know how to look at the interface because, like I said, every application does it differently.
Yeah.
Under under OS 10 in Cocoa, the interface building tools are extremely robust, work extremely well, and pretty much everyone who writes a Cocoa application is going to do everything the same way, so the screen reading software tends to work better.
Let me ask you this question, because I know a lot of blind people are going to be asking themselves, particularly the ones on 10, you know, I'd like to do something to encourage more Cocoa development. You're a software developer. Having been through all of this stuff of having to work around issues, you know, as all software developers do, how can people that are users of VoiceOver encourage people like yourself and various others? Because we have some people that, even to date, we still see out there that are not writing, certainly writing Cocoa, and it makes it hard because we have a lot of people out there who would like to use a lot of programs. There's one website that rates programs on accessibility, and I thought of submitting Rumpus as an application for them. It's called Mac Visionaries. www.macvisionaries.com, I think it is. I'll have to double-check the URL. If it's different than what I told you, I'll just send it to you. But they're trying to encourage more blind people to switch over to the Macintosh. And one of the things that they were going to start doing was a rating program for rating programs on accessibility. And, of course, you know, as we talked earlier, at least for people who are looking to do FTP, serving, Rumpus is right up there. But what can people do to encourage people like yourself more in Cocoa development?
Well, you know, other than the obvious, just, you know, writing emails or using whatever appropriate channels to contact companies, you know, I'm not actually sure what you could do. I think the big shift is going to be, or the big thing that's going to encourage people to write Cocoa applications is a belief that what they're doing is going to be useful in the long term. The real problem when Apple comes out with new technologies, the problem for software developers is some technologies stick and some don't. You look at QuickTime. Well, QuickTime came out back in, 92 probably,
yeah.
And it's really stuck. And anyone who's a QuickTime-based developer has probably done really well and has probably been real happy, as opposed to, say, Open Transport, which we adopted and, you know, is now completely defunct and Rumpus had to be rewritten for the BSD stack.
Yeah.
So as people realize that OS X is here to stay, that it's going to be a stable platform for the future, and that Apple isn't going to pull the rug out from under them, I think more and more people will adopt the Cocoa platform. And the other big thing, if you do write to some software companies or you do make suggestions, the reason that I really focused on accessibility for Rumpus wasn't so much for the accessibility aspect of it. It's because when you make interface changes that help accessibility, you improve the overall product. Okay, making sure that every button was labeled, making sure that every button has a short and helpful help text underneath it, improves the program for my entire community, not just blind people. So for me, that was really what motivated me to make sure that Rumpus was, you know, accessible.
Absolutely. Well, and see, therein lies the rub. We haven't had 10 for very long, and this is why one thing I think also that a lot of blind people need to do, and this is a comment I'm going to interject myself, encourage others to make the switch into OS 10, because there's a lot of advantages to it. As we know, OS 10 is the first system right out of the box. It has a built-in screen reader. We've never seen that before. Screen readers usually ran about $750 in a lot of cases for screen reading software that was pretty much just bolted on, so to speak. You put it in there, and this is one of the reasons I think that was so many problems for Outspoken was Outspoken read the video output. In fact, one of the problems that I hated with the previous OS is, John, is that if I ran Outspoken, I had to have a monitor plugged in, because one of the problems with the Macintosh, and I know this may, if we have any blind people out there listening to this that used 9, you probably wondered why your computer didn't work properly when you didn't have a monitor plugged in. Well, the Apple's computers don't put out any video unless there's a monitor plugged in. So what was happening was Outspoken read whatever came out of the video output. Well, if there was no video, it wasn't going to read it. So what we had to do, I had a friend of mine who was a Mac guru, that, you know, the same guy that got me into the work for the colleges up there, he made a jumper plug took pin 4 on the old video outputs and soldered it to ground, and that tricked the Macintosh into thinking there was video there. And that was how we had to run outspoken. Well, now System 10, which in some ways has really made things easy if you're a Cocoa writer, uses hooks right out of the OS, I would assume, doesn't it, John?
Yeah, I honestly don't know what happens at that low level.
Yeah.
I do think that it's a lot less of a problem. I mean, we used to use those same jumpers for us in the server market because a server doesn't need video in most cases. People were using Timbuktu or something like that to manage it. So we used those exact same plugs to run headless Macs.
Yeah, yeah, and it was a real pain back then. Now you don't have to do that because the OS will just simply ignore if there's no monitor there. So that's one great plus. Well, let me ask you this, John. Doing this work out of your home, do you just as a side note, do you have a set time in which you work through the day, or do you just depend upon how things get started when you do your work? It obviously takes some discipline to run a home business like that.
Yeah, that's the key. The key is discipline. So I pretty much do impose a schedule on myself because if I didn't, it would sort of fall off. In the summer, I get a little looser with it. Spend a little bit more time with my kids and stuff. But usually, my day consists of getting up first thing in the morning and hitting email first thing because I do have a lot of customers in Europe. And in order for them to get a same-day response, I have to answer email by 7 or 7:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
So I try to do that, and that way I'm getting them before they go home from work in case there's any back and forth on email.
Yeah.
So that's sort of my schedule for the morning, and then, around 5, 5:30, I knock off and go see what the family's up to.
Cool. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I appreciate you coming on with us here, John. And again, if you're looking for FTP, particularly to run your own server, this is it. I mean, yeah, it's a little bit on the expensive side, but it's good software. I mean, I downloaded it and I tried it. I mean, that's the good thing about it. If you try it, you installed on a Mac, and if it's not for you, the cool thing about it is that there's even a button to totally uninstall everything that's associated with it. Now, when you uninstall Rumpus, will it pull everything out, including preferences and everything, when you click that uninstall button if a person decides it's not for them?
Yeah, I'm a big believer in software that only goes as deep into your system as it absolutely needs to.
Yeah.
So besides the Rumpus application, everything is stored in a single folder. The Rumpus server daemon, the support files, everything is stored in a single folder on the system. So when you hit that uninstall button, all you're really doing is just deleting that folder.
Yeah, you're just getting rid of that whole folder, that whole contents, and it totally puts your Mac back into the state it was in before you installed it. So
yeah, Rumpus doesn't hook itself deep into your system at all. Like I said, everything is in a single folder, and it doesn't really patch any system files or anything like that. I'm not a big fan of installers. I like applications that you just drag onto your desktop or into the applications folder, and that's how I develop the software.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I thank you again for everything you're doing. Well, John, if people want to see what you're doing, they can go to maxum.com.
That's right, M-A-X-U-M.
Yeah, .com. And you do have other software up there, don't you? Is that software actually supported still, or is Rumpus is really the main thing, as you stated earlier, that you're focused on, but there is other stuff up there, right?
Well, over the course of the past, 15 years, Maxum has released probably half a dozen or seven different products, and I still support each and every one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But Rumpus is the only one that we're actively selling. We did have a product until recently called iAssist, and we pulled that when Rumpus version 5 came out because the reason people needed iAssist has been incorporated. The functionality of iAssist that people were interested in has been incorporated into Rumpus. So now when you get Rumpus 5, not only do you get that functionality, but you get it for the same price as just the Rumpus package itself. So we no longer needed that. And so iAssist was just discontinued a couple of weeks ago.
Ah, okay. Very good. Well, let me ask you this question in case there's somebody out there that has a need. Now, you may not be in the mode to do this or whatever, but if somebody is in a pinch and they need something developed, are you for hire to develop anything if somebody needs your services or something, or you mainly just want to stay focused right on this one thing that you're doing? Because that's one of the problems I find sometimes is there's a need out there once in a while for something that nobody's making, and somebody's saying, "My God, I wish somebody would take this idea and put it into some code and make it happen."
Yeah, I hear that once in a while. I don't usually do projects like that. I'm probably not the best suited. But if someone has questions like that, go to my website and send me an email. There's a contacts page on the website, and I'm happy to try to hook people up. I do know people in the Mac development community, and probably headed off to WWDC here in a couple of months. And so I definitely try to help people out when I can.
Yeah, so if you're looking for something, if there's something or, you know, something that's not currently out there that you'd like to see out there, that would certainly be a way to get the ball started. Even if John couldn't do it himself, you know, somebody else might be able to do it. And that's one of the reasons I'm glad we had you up here, because the Mac right now is just starting to really take off for blind people. And I'm starting to see them, and I'm glad of that, because I kind of felt like the lone stranger out here, because I was running a Mac, and every time I turned around prior to System 10, everybody's saying, you know, I'm a Windows guy. That Macintosh is this. Everybody had all these false, they were false misconceptions even about the Mac back when OS 9 was around. But some of it was earned because of the problem with screen reading software, where on the Windows side, there were two or three, maybe even four, and I may be underestimating even still, screen readers for Windows, but only one for Mac. Well, now there's still only one for Mac, but it's integrated right into the OS. And so part of the reason I had you up here for this interview is every bit to promote the Mac as much as it is for promoting Rumpus as an FTP server. And I just love the software. And when there's something that I like, I want to share it with people, and I want to let them know it's out there. And if it's for you, fine. If not, that's good. But at least you know there is an FTP server for the Macintosh. That's the main thing. Now we need go ahead.
People will sometimes say, you know, yeah, there's an FTP server for the Mac. And like you said, you know, there was one screen reader for the Mac, and there might be six or seven for the PC. But the key is which one is the best. I mean, you don't need six or seven FTP servers. You need one, and you need it to be the best one. And hopefully the Mac, if it doesn't have the sheer quantity of software, again, all you need is one good application. If we can get the quality of the software up, I think that's the key. And with Apple's development tools, I think they're doing that. So.
Yeah, and you can. I even know of one case of a blind person who is experimenting with developing software himself, you know, based on some of Apple's applications such as Preview, and making them even more accessible than Apple did, and they were pretty accessible then. So there is a lot of encouraging things going on out there. Just need to be patient and ride this horse, because I think it's going to go somewhere. We still have Leopard coming around the corner. Have you heard anything on that, John, up to this point, as far as anything regarding Leopard? Is Apple probably hasn't let anything out of the box, even to if there's going to be any major changes again that'll beat you guys over the head or whatever.
Yeah, I haven't heard a whole lot more than, you know, what the rumor sites, the Mac rumor sites show. The big thing will be WWDC. I'm sure, I'm absolutely positive that that'll be Apple's key focus for WWDC, which is the Apple Worldwide Developers Conference. And that's where Apple, that show, that trade show has actually been bigger and bigger every year. Apple's really using that as a platform. A couple of years ago when I went, 10.3 was the big one, and at the time, you know, we were on 10.2.2 or something, and
yeah.
And I mean, every course that you could take at WWDC was about 10.3, and I'm sure the same is going to be true in August.
Absolutely. Well, John, I want to thank you for doing this interview, and I hope we have some people who will come and investigate what's going on, and also I hope this will encourage among other things, encourage more people to give their input into the Mac community. And the main thing is understand that there are, I mean, it's just like when I talked to you yesterday, I gave you some input on some of the lesser known buttons, and there obviously is there are some limitations in the Cocoa interface. They weren't major limitations. They were just a few minor buttons that didn't have that I didn't know exactly what they were until I played with them, because they were just buttons. But I'm glad to say that is so far few and far between in Rumpus that once you figure out what they are and where they are, they stay in the same place, and they don't necessarily have to be labeled. But just, you know, the thing is that people got to remember is that sometimes there are limitations to what you can do with a given design based on the interface that you're working with, right?
Yeah, well, what you just said is really the key. When you're dealing with a legacy interface, when you're moving software from version 3 to 4 or 4 to 5, and you're continuing on with an interface that was designed maybe 3 years ago, yeah, you are limited. In the case that you mentioned, certain buttons weren't designed to be labeled, and when you put labels on them, they just don't look right, and it causes problems in the interface. And then, you know, but as we move forward, and for example, I think the Rumpus interface, the current Rumpus interface, is for my taste getting a little cluttered. So in the next major revision, I'm sure that there's going to be some shifts, and when I shift the interface, I'll be able to address those issues, because the legacy won't be won't have the same weight.
Right. I know what you mean, and I mean, there is a lot of stuff out there when you first open it, but I'm glad to say there's a lot of descriptions next to them wherever you put major buttons like define users, server setup, management tools. The list goes on and on. You know, when you go through those and you're reading down through the list, it gives you all the explanation you really need. So, I didn't even have to. I'm the kind of guy, John, I get a product, I use it, and then I read the manual.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I did with Rumpus, and I had no trouble at all. So
that's extremely common.
Yeah. I mean, I'm by that so many cases. You know, I always think, you know, somebody out there probably, you know, would probably, you know, you always have these people out there, please read the user's manual before using this product, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And I'm thinking, well, I bucked that horse a long time ago, and software is no different. You know, if I run into a snag, then I go back and, oh yeah, there is a manual in the package. I better take a good look at it. And of course, there are comprehensive PDFs that you can open in there. Well, John,
well, actually, most people, like I said, are do exactly what you do. They open the software up and they start to work with it, and that's why Rumpus doesn't actually even include a user's manual anymore. We used to have a printed thing called the user's guide, and it was a 120-page document, and
yeah,
I don't even have that anymore. What I did is I broke it into articles that are stored in a folder called the helpful info folder,
yeah.
And each article covers a single topic. I mean, you could think of it as a chapter in a book, but the idea is that someone doesn't want to grab a book and read it cover to cover. The idea is that someone's going to be able to use the software, get the basics started, and then when they say, you know, I want to find out a little bit more about how user accounts work so that I can use them in depth, or how do I set up an event notice, and they can go into that helpful info folder, and there's an article on that specific task. And because, yeah, user's manuals, I think, are kind of a thing of the past.
Yeah, and I agree, because, you know, they get so long and drawn out if it's one continuous thing. And that kind of thing. And most people, time is valuable. I know ours is here. Let me ask you one question here before we get done here. Would you say that writing for 10 is easier than writing for 9, or is it the other way around?
Well, the Project Builder and Interface Builder tools that Apple provides are really top-notch. The interface tools that used to be that you used to use for OS 8 and 9, like I said, had so many limitations and problems that I, for one, basically wrote my own interface library. So from an interface standpoint, certainly easier on Cocoa. You basically just just draw the interface, lay it out, and it works just the way you'd want. And it's extremely flexible. Every time I've ever wanted to do something, you know, you do a Google search and you're able to figure it out. So from an interface standpoint, it's certainly better. And the tools underneath, you also have the Unix shell, which is so reliable, so robust, and there's so much published for it that in a sense, the inner workings are also easier. So I suppose ultimately it's a lot easier. The downside is that there is so much to comprehend. I mean, BSD Unix is just huge. Cocoa is just huge. And there's so much to learn. From that standpoint, you know, it's a little more difficult. But, you know, basically the bottom line is you have a bigger tool set. There's a little bit more to learn. But once you do, it's killer.
Wow, that's great. Well, I encourage, you know, if you're a blind person out there and you want to take a stab at learning how to develop, get in there and get your hands wet. I mean, the most you can do is you may start out with something that doesn't work very well or works mediocre, and then you can build off of that. And as you learn, you can improve the product. That's how a lot of would-be shareware people do it. Would you? Yep. Is that how you would encourage it, John?
Yeah, you know, every version of Mac OS X includes the developer tools. You usually have to install them separately, but they're on the DVD or the CDs or whatever you've got. So they're there. There's a book that I started with when I first started the transition to OS X called Cocoa Programming for Mac OS X. It's by a guy named Aaron Hillegass. He also runs a seminar series called Big Nerd Ranch down, I think it's in Texas.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if the book is available online so that your computer can read it to you. But it's enormously helpful. It takes you from building the Hello World simplest application through some fairly complicated stuff, and it's just a great introduction to Cocoa. If you're a C programmer or C++ or you know Objective-C, it's a great way to get started programming on the Mac.
Absolutely. Well, John, I want to thank you so much for coming on here, taking time out of your day to come on and do this, because I know this is going to be a great encouragement to a lot of the blind people that are out there that are using the Mac. You're not alone. I'm running six of the doggone things here, one of which is my server. And if you have any questions, if you have any misgivings about wanting to start a server or something, you can certainly contact me for the experience that I've had as the user. And, of course, you can also download the software and give it a whirl yourself. And if it's for you, fine. About the most, really, John, I guess I'd have to say about the most you may have to worry about in running a server is that your hard disks are active all the time, so you want to make sure your disks are in order. Don't go sticking a hard drive in there that's 6 years old or something and expect it to work flawlessly if it's been used a lot. You want to have fresh hard drives, which is what we've just done here. And but as far as Rumpus running on a machine, it doesn't have to be the fastest Mac. I mean, I'm running 450 megahertz, and you are too over there. I know we had this conversation mm-hmm. yesterday, and Rumpus runs just fine on a 450 megahertz Mac. So you can take that old Mac. If you got an old Mac stuck in a closet somewhere, you can pull that thing out maybe for less than $100 for a hard drive, and then just the expense of the software, which you can get in two versions. I only have the standard because I never have the plans to run a big system here. But, I mean, you could set up an old Mac as a server, can't you?
Yeah, until a couple of months ago, I was running www.maxim.com on a first-generation tray-loading iMac, you know, one of the original Bondi Blue.
Yeah.
I think it was a 233 megahertz G3, you know, the oldest machine you could possibly run OS X on. And I was running a web server, Rumpus, NetCloak, Page Sentry, which is another obsolete product of ours that monitored web servers, probably at least a half a dozen applications on that same machine. And the only reason I decommissioned it was because, I was afraid the hard drives, I was afraid of an eventual failure. And also, frankly, they just consumed a lot of electricity and spit out a lot of heat. And my office isn't that big, so it was getting pretty warm in here. So I put a cube in there, which puts out a lot less heat. That was the biggest reason.
Yeah, the biggest recent change that you made. And, yeah, I know what you're talking about, because you can't turn the monitors off in those iMacs. And so
Yeah, and it was, like I said, it was using electricity, but otherwise it was a great server. I mean, servers they're not CPU hogs. If you look at Rumpus on most systems, even when someone's transferring a file at full internet speed, Rumpus will be using 5% of the CPU or something like that, even on a relatively slow machine. It's just, it doesn't need the horsepower of a Photoshop or something, or an audio processing program, something that uses a lot of CPU.
Yeah. And one thing I failed to mention, too, is that there's a web interface that goes with Rumpus, so you can do HTTP using Internet Explorer or something like that. So if a person's not familiar with how to use an FTP client, you can go that route. And that web interface is totally customizable, isn't it? If a person was acquainted with HTML, could they not write their own code for that if they wanted a special designed interface or something? Or how does that how would that work?
Yeah, we call it the Web File Manager, and it's basically the same functionality as FTP, but through a web browser. Most web browsers actually support FTP, but since they're web browsers, FTP is kind of an afterthought. And we just got so many people, so many requests, why doesn't Rumpus work with Explorer very well? Why doesn't? And the fact is, the Rumpus worked just fine. Explorer had the same problem with any FTP server. So rather than try to fight a losing battle of getting the browsers to do better FTP, we made our FTP server do web. So basically people can upload files, download files, delete files, manage content, create folders, all the normal FTP things with a standard web interface. And that web interface is fully customizable. So, it can be simplified or expanded on as you need.
Yeah, and it's all out of the one application, out of the controller application. There's no additional software other than the buttons you might want to check to install. Now, that is a daemon process too, right, that gets installed when you decide to activate the web interface. Does that not install another daemon process somewhere?
Well, it actually is part of the same daemon.
Okay.
So there's a single daemon that's running on your machine, and it provides both FTP and web services.
Oh, okay. Very good. Well, John, thanks again for coming on the broadcast, and it's been a joy doing this podcast for everybody, and I hope we've got some people thinking out there regarding the future of the Macintosh, and by all means, word of mouth is the best thing. If you can convince somebody to at least try the Mac, and I know in the future for those of you that have been asking, I know I had one person, Harry up in Michigan, you asked me about a friend of yours that wanted to learn the Mac. I will in the future do a tutorial, a basic Mac basics tutorial for Blind Cool Tech. And you guys can download that, do anything you want with it, share it with whomever you want. It's just going to be a basic how to navigate the Mac with VoiceOver, how to navigate some applications, that kind of thing. And we're going to talk about some applications that are accessible versus non-accessible. And hopefully that'll get you guys out of the gate, because that's the easiest way to do it. I've done tech support before, and I'm telling you, to do this on a one-on-one basis, you never get anything else done. But if I can put this out there, and it's a very basic tutorial, you can go and play it as many times as you want, and that way you'll have it. So anyway, that answers that question. We'll answer some of the other ones on an upcoming podcast. John, thanks again, and let me go ahead and we'll get out of here with this. And folks, enjoy your Macintoshes out there. This is Sam Britton, and so long, and blessings, and we'll be back soon with yet more.